You're listening to KPFT, Houston, 90.1 FM.
George Jones is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas no longer has public hangings, but witness with us the legal homicide by lethal injection of George Jones in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Lubeck, vigil reporter in Houston Nancy Bailey, and special guest Scott Christensen, investigative reporter and author of The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of the American Gas Chamber. The Execution Watch begins. Don't you know they're killing people? 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 Don't you know they're killing people?
This is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. You may also be listening on the World Wide Web on executionwatch.org, to which is linked theprisonshow.org or kpft.org. And all of these orgs come together to bring you an unusual program. Every time there is an execution in Texas, we gather in this little studio, several of us, to discuss that case and that execution, its actual history, its legal history, as the state of Texas goes methodically about its business, which is a ritual of taking Mr. George Jones, who is now 36 years old, and carrying him to the death chamber, strapping him on a gurney. Needles have already been placed in his arms before the witnesses get there. And the first report we will have is from Huntsville to verify that the witnesses have, in fact, crossed the road. By crossing the road means 12th Street, which is in front of the Walls Prison. They move from the old administration building, where they gather in the public information and media relations department of Texas prisons, and they're escorted from there into the Walls, into the back of the Walls, where there is a death chamber. And I believe we have Gloria on the air. Gloria, can you hear me?
Hey, Ray.
Tell us what's going on.
Well, it's a very quiet afternoon here in Huntsville. There's a half a dozen of us here protesting the execution, including Carl Rodenberg from Germany and a woman whose name I'm not sure how to pronounce, from Holland, and three of us from Houston and the professor from Huntsville. The media just went in. It seemed to be only Michael Grashek, the Associated Press reporter, and one other, I guess, the Huntsville item. I don't know who took over when What's-Her-Face got named public information officer. And then the witnesses went in, and it appeared to be only George Jones's father. His mom and dad had been visiting him for the last several days and told him goodbye today, but there was no sign of the mother going in, which is not unusual at all. Very, very few mothers can witness an execution.
Well,
there's not a single reporter out here talking to us, and just a little bit low-key.
Well, give our regards to the other vigilants. Our friends from from Germany and Holland have been there for the last couple of demonstrations.
Right.
So that's what the professor told us. Give our regards to the professor. And we are going to go on and talk about the case and the legal history of the case. If anything happens, be sure and get in contact with Elizabeth.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that reporter is Gloria Rubeck. And Gloria Rubeck is, in addition to being a reporter up there, she is one of the founders and activists in the death penalty abolition movement. And you can be get their face page book by going to Abolition Movement through the Face Page Index. She has also worked with the prison show and is a frequent vigilant. And with me in the studio is Jim Skelton. Hello, Jim.
How are you doing, Ray?
I am well. I'm apparently better shaped than Mr. Jones. Tell us about this case.
Well, George Jones was a member of a group of guys that were doing a lot of carjacking in Dallas. He had, at least during the trial, there were like five aggravated robberies he was involved in. And on this particular case, is on April 13th, 1993, he and four others, including a guy by the name of Derek Rogers, went to a mall in Dallas just to look for somebody to rob. And they saw a young man get out of a white car, and his name was Forrest J. Hall. He's a 22-year-old young man. They saw him go inside the mall, and they waited till he got back. Then they pulled a gun on him and forced him back in the car and drove him out to a strip outside of Dallas. And he and this guy, Derek Rogers, got him out of the car. And then the people who had been with them, they were going to plan the robbery, followed in another car.
So there were four people involved.
Only two people that actually did the abduction, and there were four people involved in the robbery. And what they did, they got him out of the car and had him to lay face down on the ground and shot him back at the head twice with two bullet holes and killed him. And then they left his body there. And the police found his car sometime later. He had been stripped. What they traditionally had been doing with these carjackings are stealing people's cars and stripping them, taking off the hubcaps, I mean, fancy wheels, taking out any type of extra stuff like stereos, things of this nature they could pawn and hawk. And apparently from the evidence gathered at trial, George Jones is kind of a street person. He'd not been in the prison before, not been a part of the criminal system by being on probation. But he's apparently making his living selling drugs and doing carjackings and doing robberies. And they had no particular leads on how to find the killers. They found this poor guy's body, found his car that had been pretty well stripped and everything taken off of it. And then about a week later, police were chasing a stolen car. And after the car, they caught they stopped the car, but the guy in the car escaped. Inside the car was a .380 caliber pistol. That ended up being the pistol used in the robbery killing of this young man by the name of Forrest J. Hall. But they had no suspects of the guy who was driving the stolen car they couldn't find. And then the opinions don't say, but somehow about 5 months later, Derek Rogers is picked up and he makes a confession to all of this. He confesses to the killing of Forrest Hall and being his involvement in it and told the police basically what occurred. And based upon that, they go to George Jones' home and arrest him. While they're there, they find, number one, they find a lot of the equipment taken out of the car, the stereo and some more things have been stripped from the car they found inside George Jones' house. They also found pawn receipts and discovered that he had pawned the hubcaps at a pawn shop that they'd stolen off the car. And a forensic examiner is able to trace the signature of the person who pawned the shop to George Jones. George Jones also confessed to the police. And so they had a confession, plus they had the stolen equipment taken from this murder case in his possession after the murder. And then what happened at trial, Derek Rogers had been apparently tried earlier. They cut a deal. The opinions do not say. He ends up with 22 years for aggravated robbery. Nonetheless, he ends up testifying in George Jones' trial. So what the state had is evidence. Number one, they had a confession from Mr. Jones. Number two, they had stolen property in his possession that they got when he was arrested. Then they had the testimony of Derek Rogers. And Derek Rogers' girlfriend was one of the four people that were at the mall when the robbery occurred. And she followed in another car. And she pretty well verified what Derek Rogers had said, because she saw them take this man out to the country road, saw him get out of the car with his hands up, and then she drove away and heard two shots. And apparently she later asked George Jones about why he killed this young man, Forrest Hall. And his response was, "I didn't want him to live to see his son." That was brought out during the trial. Seems a little odd. I mean, I don't know how they even got into the fact that this kid had a son. He's only 22 years old. And that's what he says. I didn't want him to live to see his son. Also, at punishment, they introduce evidence that about 5 months after this particular murder, that that George Jones was a part of another group that abducted another carjacking on a 20-year-old woman. They took her out to a lonely site, made her strip all of her clothes off, and they shot her in the head twice, just like they had done Forrest Hall. And after they shot her, George Jones wasn't certain that she was dead. So he goes back to the scene with a shotgun and shoots her in the face. So what the jury had at punishment hearing, they had two murders, both of them with no particular reason to kill anybody. They had a series of like 5 aggravated robberies and carjackings. They had evidence that he had been apparently living on the street selling drugs, doing robberies, and doing carjackings. And he was only 19 years old at the time of the offense, and the jury in Dallas County had no problem giving him the death penalty based upon these facts. When the case went up on appeal, a lawyer by the name of Richard Anderson did the brief. Richard is a well-known lawyer in Dallas, a very fine lawyer, did an extremely thorough job. And really the only thing they had to work with, and you see this a lot in death penalty cases, they had some problems when the judge excused some jurors for cause based on the state's challenge for cause that claim were improper. But the problem is, and even the court agreed that it was an improper excusal of a juror. But the problem is, whenever a juror is excused by a state's challenge for cause, the only way it's reversible error if you can prove you were tried by an impartial jury. And that's virtually impossible to ever prove that the jury you had was impossible. And that was really the major issue they had was on appeal. Plus, there was another issue, but these things...
Well, now, what happened to that jury? Was dismissed before the trial?
Well, when they were selecting the jury. When you see in a death penalty case, the way it works, it's different than selecting a jury in a regular case. They interview all the jurors individually. And what they do, they put them on the witness stand. And the judge will basically tell the juror what the case is about, and the prosecution will question the juror. And when the prosecution gets through, they will pass the juror to the defense, and the defense questions the juror. At the end of that time, they can make a challenge for cause. At the end of that, they make that at that moment, each side gets 15 strikes. And the state challenged her for cause because primarily what she said was she wouldn't believe the testimony of an accomplice witness. She would have a hard time believing that. And of course, they knew in advance that Derek Rogers, who was an accomplice in the robbery and the murder, was going to testify.
Even though that accomplice witness had corroborating evidence and testimony.
Right. But she still said she wouldn't believe the accomplice. That's what the base of the strike is. Well, you have to go further than that. When you're saying somebody has a particular bias, you've got to go further and ask this magic question. Is this bias so strong you can't set it aside? Because everybody has biases, sure, and they have interests. And the question is, can you set that aside and follow the law and be fair and impartial? I didn't ask her that question. She just simply said she'd have a hard time believing the testimony of an accomplice witness. Well, that isn't sufficient to strike somebody. Mm-hmm. And the court agreed it was insufficient to strike, and the court trial judge made an error by letting the state strike that particular juror. And so what happened, then they ruled that in this particular case that there's no error proven. They had this horrible thing called the harmless error rule. And what it basically says, you've got to be able to show that the mistake contributed somehow to the mistake contributed to the punishment or to the finding of guilt. And they said in this particular case, you have to show you were tried with an impartial jury. Therefore, there's no harm because he wasn't able to demonstrate the jury was impartial. Plus, there was also pretty well overwhelming evidence of guilt because you had a confession. You had Derek Rogers' testimony. You had the girlfriend verifying what Derek Rogers had said. And then you had the stolen items found inside of George Jones's house. And that's a pretty strong case to find somebody guilty. And then the accomplice witness had really nothing to do with the punishment part. That was just on guilt or innocence. And what they argued on the punishment part, the state was permitted when they proved up the second murder. It was an 18-year-old girl they killed and about 5 months after they killed this kid, Forrest Hall. They introduced some graphic photographs showing the face of the lady who had been shot in the head twice and then shot with a shotgun. And the argument was made that that's more prejudicial than it is relevant. And everybody agreed that it's relevant to show, in fact, that she was shot. And you don't need a photograph really to say that's what courts say. And what they said over and over again with these gruesome photographs, if a verbal account of a murder is admissible, then the photograph likewise is admissible. Mm-hmm. They've even gone so far in cases like this to introduce autopsy photographs of young children on an autopsy table with their head cut open.
Yeah.
And they said that's not error to admit that photograph. And that was one of the issues on appeal, is whether or not it was proper to admit the photograph. And, of course, the court said it was proper to do so. And then what happened when he gets up through the writ system, he later filed a subsequent quit claiming he was retarded. But as you well know, that has not worked a whole lot, has mm-hmm. not worked well, because in order to be retarded where they can't execute you, it's got to be some type of mental problem you had before the age of 18. You had to have a low IQ and no adaptive skills. They weren't able to cross that threshold. All it did was just delay the execution. And that was basically the argument on writ. There was not any argument that I could find that the lawyers were ineffective, because they didn't have a whole lot to work with. When you have somebody who's 19 with that track record of robberies and killing two people and kind of cruelly killing, go back and shooting somebody in the head with a shotgun after you shot him twice.
Pretty serious stuff.
And then, you know, I'm not too sure how swift this guy George Jones is, because he was interviewed in prison a couple of days ago. And his story was that he used that old convict stuff, did this and did that, that convict talk. And he said he shot the guy in self-defense. Well, it's really hard to believe that somebody shot somebody twice.
In the back of the head.
Right, close range in self-defense. In fact, the only time I can remember that ever worked, if you remember Billy Saul Estes years ago, there was an agriculture guy who was investigating him on these fake ammonia tanks, and he committed suicide by shooting himself in the back four times with a bolt-action rifle.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that case.
And that's the only time I've ever heard that story.
We've had homicides in Houston where fathers of the deceased signed the death warrant. People were shot with a rifle in the middle of the chest.
It's kind of hard to imagine getting shot in self-defense. You have two close contact wounds in the back of the head.
Right.
I don't imagine how that, when that's the guy I was backing into, he's going to run over you or something. And that's what he was claiming. He admit, in fact, in other times he's just denied being there.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of witnesses putting him there. We have property found in his home. We have the accomplice witness testifying against him. And two bad murder cases, and that's why he got the death penalty.
Yeah, he has had a last-minute, a good bit of media. He's had allowed several interviews here at the last minute.
But he hasn't helped himself with those interviews.
No, I didn't see that he was majorly improving his rationale. This may be a completely off-the-wall question having nothing to do with anything. But if the police had the pawn slips and they had somebody else's testimony that he was the dude, why did they need, a confession from him?
Well, of course, when they first interviewed him, they hadn't tracked down the pawn slips. They hadn't tracked down the hubcaps at that point. It's when they arrested him is when they got the confession.
Okay.
It was later they picked that up. And it's a typical thing. One of the mistakes prosecutions often make is over prosecuting a case, over killing.
Yeah.
And they never, ever, ever get enough evidence. They always want a confession. I remember, if you remember about 15 years ago, maybe it's 20 years ago, every case the arson fire department always had a confession.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was a prosecutor, Wade bought me a confession one time. And what involved an Indian who set his wife's negligee on fire and scorched the back of the door. It would take a paintbrush to clean up the scorch.
Yeah.
The file, I measured it, was thicker than the length of the scorch mark, and there was a confession in it. And they always got confessions out of the arson division. I guess they hung them outside with their heels or something. But they always want confessions if they can get a confession.
What effect on all that has the Supreme Court case that's come down the last couple of days?
Well, a lot of people don't understand exactly what the Supreme Court case did, because the reason they don't, because you have to understand what Miranda held. Here's what Miranda said. Miranda said there's two things that have got to happen whenever you're in custody and they think you're the suspect. They got to warn you of a right to remain silent, warn you that you, anything you say can be used against you until you have a right to a lawyer. Now, that's one thing. They give people Miranda warnings. The second part of Miranda says this. There must be evidence that the defendant waived those rights. And you can give them the Miranda warning, and if they still confess, but there's no indication of a waiver, that confession is not admissible. So Miranda stands for two things. You got to be warned of your rights, and number two, there's got to be evidence you waived those rights and understood them. Mm-hmm. Well, in every confession form, all right, they have forms all over the police department where defendants sign saying, I have received my Miranda warnings. And also we have culpable warnings in our statute in Article 3822. And that warning always says, I've been received my rights and I waive them. Well, this defendant that went up on the Supreme Court refused to sign that form. So whenever you have a situation like this, someone's been Mirandized and they refuse to sign a form acknowledging the fact they received Miranda warnings and refusing to acknowledge the fact they waived them, there's a real strong presumption he did not waive his rights. Mm-hmm. So what they argued in that case were two things. Because what happened, they picked this guy up and they interrogated him for 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And he remained silent during the entire 2.5 hours except for some responses like, yes, no, this seat is too hard, and I don't know. And he just sat there and wouldn't talk. He would look down and wouldn't talk to the police. And even the police said our interrogation was a monologue on our part. And he refused to sign any type of acknowledgement that he had understood his rights and waived them. At the end of 2.5 hours, one of the policemen found out he was somewhat religious and said to this gentleman, have you asked God to forgive you for your part in that murder? And he said, yes. Well, they admitted the confession at trial, and the argument was made that, number one, when he sat mute for 2.5 hours, that was in effect invoking his right to remain silent. And number two, the state did not prove that he waived his rights under Miranda. Those were the arguments made. And the Michigan courts all affirmed it. The trial court admitted. The Sixth Circuit reversed the case. And here's what the Sixth Circuit said. The Sixth Circuit said that the state did not carry its burden to prove that he waived his rights because after 2.5 hours remaining mute and answering one question with a yes was not sufficient to show a waiver of his rights. Supreme Court reversed that, and they basically killed that section of Miranda. Because Miranda now, if you follow that case, all they have to do is give you a warning. But if the state doesn't prove a waiver after this case, I don't think the state will ever have to prove a waiver. Because, I mean, only I think most logical people would think that if a guy is set and said nothing for 2.5 hours and finally he says, yes, I've asked God to forgive me, I don't think most people construe that as a waiver of his right to remain silent.
Or for many people, it wouldn't even be a confession.
Right. Well, he just simply said, yes, I've asked God to forgive me for all. He said, the question was, have you asked God to forgive you for your part of this murder? And he said, yes. That was it. And the Supreme Court, in his opinion written by Kennedy, just simply took, I think we got a call coming
in. Yeah, we got Gloria.
Yeah, hey.
What's going on?
Well, Michael Gresham came out and Michelle Lyons came out. And I must have missed the family, but I'm sure they've come out. And the execution's over. And, you know, we were just talking that this was a very quiet evening. But in a week and a half when David Powell is set for execution, the Austin Police Department on their webpage, their lead story is to get your seat on the chartered bus and book your room at the Holiday Inn Express in Huntsville.
Hmm.
So the next execution on the...
is an Austin case involving an officer.
Right.
Yeah, well, don't they always have a supportive demonstration if it's a police officer? I know they did during Billy Hughes's execution.
Yeah, and Dennis and I were trying to remember the one earlier this year where they came from Dallas, and I can't remember who was... the person executed that night. And they had said they were chartering a bus, but if they did, about every other seat was empty. But I know when...
One of the Texas Seven, the one that volunteered.
Oh, that's right. When David went to the Fifth Circuit, the Austin Police Department, I'm sure most of those officers weren't even born yet when the crime happened, but they filled the courtroom with the Fifth Circuit.
That's hard to do. Fifth Circuit's a pretty good-sized courtroom.
Exactly.
Gloria, tell me, did you know George?
No, I didn't, actually. To be honest, I had never heard his name till it came up on the list. And, you know, I guess because there's just so damn many.
Well, I've got you on the line. Gloria, you've obviously been an activist in this area for a long, long time. How would you explain the motivation for your concern about the death penalty?
Well, I'm an activist around a lot of issues, and I think that the death penalty is just one of many social justice issues that needs to be fought. The other motivation is that I witnessed my friend Carlos Santana's execution in 1993, and that was back before victims' families could go in. So we were literally, I don't know, 6 feet apart in the execution room.
Mm-hmm.
And as he lay on the gurney, he said, "Promise me you won't stop fighting the death penalty." And I promised him, and I'm a person that keeps my promises. So I hope to one day contact Carlos's two sons in the Dominican Republic. And
all right. Tell us about the Texas death penalty abolition movement.
Well, we actually just met last night. We meet on the first Tuesday of the month, and we've got a lot of things going on this month. We're going to be part of the Democrats Against the Death Penalty Caucus meeting at the Democratic Party State Convention in Corpus Christi the weekend of the 25th and 26th of June. We're going to be going to Austin on June 18th for Sharon Killer Keller's face-off with the Texas Commission on Judicial Conduct for closing the court at 5 instead of taking Michael Richard's appeal back in September of 07 when the U.S. Supreme Court had accepted a Kentucky case that shut down executions in the United States for about 9 months. So we're going to be doing that. And on the 19th or 20th, we're trying to pin down a location as we speak. We will be commemorating Shaka Sankofa, who will have been executed 10 years.
Has it been that long?
This month, back in June 22nd, 2000. So we're a very activist organization. We do a lot of things and a lot of action, a lot of outreach, a lot of education.
Other than going over to Shape Center on the first Tuesday of every month and catching a meeting in progress, how do people get in touch with you?
Our email is abolition.movement@hotmail.com.
Abolition.movement@hotmail.com.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Gloria.
And
be careful coming back.
Beth and everybody for doing the execution watch.
And I suppose we'll see you Friday.
Actually, I'm going to be in New York City.
All right. Give our regards to your activist friends there.
I will, and I'm going to be picking up hopefully a DVD copy of the video that will show called the U.S.'s Greatest Legal Lynching, which is about Shaka's execution.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That was Gloria Ruback, friend of Execution Watch and friend of the Prison Show, frequent guest or... She's actually a staff member. Jim, what do lawyers think about this whole execution thing? Is there any universal belief?
I'm sad to say that a lot of lawyers are just kind of worn out. They get desensitized after a while, especially here in Houston, if you've been in so many death penalty cases before.
Well, Will Gray never became desensitized.
Yeah, but the problem with Will basically had a word processor. Most of all of his petitions were the same. It was kind of like a factory, the way they cranked them out. And Will was obsessed with that, and that's just typical Will, though. I knew Will quite well, and that was typical Will. But
you might have opposed Will when you were in your prosecutor years.
Well, one of the more interesting things, Will was a good appellate lawyer, was a horrible trial lawyer. Mm-hmm. And Judge Love one time, Will and I were pretty close, and Judge Love called me up and he said, can you please talk to Will and tell him to quit trying cases, to hire somebody to try his cases? Because Will could not relate to people real well. He just didn't have the ability or the personality to try a jury trial. And that's why he was a good appellate lawyer, because, you know, his social life was so bad he had plenty of time to do research.
Right. But you mentioned another fellow there. You mentioned Judge Love. Judge Love was a pretty good lawyer in his day.
He did probate work. What's real interesting about him, he was practicing with a lawyer named Chris Dixie. Mm-hmm. And he was the very first judge the Liberal Democrats got appointed on the bench. Chris Dixie and a guy named Percy Selden and your good friend Billie Jean Carr, the ones that got him on the bench. And he was the very first judge in Texas to ever give probation to a marijuana case. And they thought he was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Love, like I say, was the first liberal judge we ever had on the bench here in Harris County. And he was put in, of course, by the Liberal Democrats. And he did I worked in his court. I was a prosecutor in his court for a number of years because they figured I'm probably the only prosecutor in history who's ever been a member of the ACLU and be a prosecutor at the same time. And they put me in his court. They figured get all the nutty liberals in one place and we couldn't do too much damage. And what was interesting about Judge Love, he got burned real badly in scandal involving Sam Hoover when they tried to tie him into. Sam Hoover was the mayor of Pasadena, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very famous and good criminal lawyer who was also involved in fencing stolen property and setting up robberies and burglaries. Just one of the many minor things he did. When Sam finally got busted, they tried to tie Judge Love into all of this and even ran a search warrant on his house. After that, Love began to back off. He would talk a real strong stand away from the bench. But when he got on the bench, he didn't back up what he had to say because I think that burned him pretty badly. And truthfully, he enjoyed being a judge, and he'd gotten defeated. He would never have been able to make the sort of money he made as a judge. And I think that's one of the reasons he quit sitting on the bench toward the latter part of his life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got Nancy coming in. Nancy?
Hi.
Hi, darling. I am sad to report to you that George Jones is now dead.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes, ma'am. And where are you?
Well, I am on my way home from the vigil at the corner of Benz and Main.
Yeah, you went out to the Methodist Church there at Benz.
Church, yes.
Did you have a good crowd tonight?
Yeah, we had a relatively small crowd. We had about 7 people, but some of our regulars are out of town.
Okay.
And in the summer months, people travel, and so we have a small number.
Well, Nancy, did you get any response from the passersby?
Well, the only responses that we got were good. Several people honked. Several people gave us the thumbs up. One of them rolled down her window and asked for the website. So,
all right.
You know, I would say that the response is a heck of a lot better than it used to be.
Yeah, well, mentioning the website, Nancy is an active member and a board member of the Texas
Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
And that website is
www.tcadp.org.
TCADP.org.
Org. Yes.
Okay, Nancy, be careful going home, and we will talk to you, unfortunately, the next time we have one of these things.
I'm afraid so. Take care, eh?
Bye-bye. And that was Nancy Bailey. That organization people approach it. Gloria is an old radical activist, a friend of mine from the 60s, actually, and still at it. And then along came Dave, who organized TCADP. And that's a kind of middle class approach to the same thing. Those folks are Democrats and some Republicans and otherwise. So it gives you an idea of the spectrum of political beliefs to be involved in this issue. And I was having a conversation with Jim. We've got another guest coming in by phone, but in the interim period, Jim, most of us don't get to peek behind the curtain down at the courthouse.
Correct.
And it is kind of a form of show business.
Well, it probably is show business, but the game, you know, they gamble with people's lives. It's
serious as anything, but there is a culture there.
Sure.
And when somebody goes to hire a lawyer and the lawyer says, oh, well, I know the judge. Well, that's really not surprising. Most lawyers know the judge.
Well, that's like saying a Jew knows Hitler. He's going to kill you. That doesn't help a hell of a lot. I mean, you know some of these guys, but if they're a bastard, they're going to be a bastard whether you know them or not.
Yeah, okay. Well, we now have Scott on the air. Scott?
Hi, Ray.
Hi. Scott, I was scanning your book and looking over the wonderful things you did. So before we begin, you started, you're a reporter?
Yes, I'm a longtime reporter. And an academic as well.
And you started stringing stories together and your research together to come up with this wealth of information in this book. But then as I scan your other books, I see several.
Yes.
And is that the reporter's duty as you see it?
Well, it is, but it was really as a reporter that I first began covering the prison system. And it was by covering the prison system that ultimately I got into the death penalty and also the field of criminal justice, which has kept me occupied since 1972.
Well, I have friends that cover that same beat down here. The one at the Austin American Statesman is a very fine reporter. But the brains of our current governor, who's not real sensitive to death penalty, was also Kathy Fair. Became Kathy Walt after marriage, and so she covered that beat, and she and I kind of went up together, me in the capacity of the prison show and her in the capacity of the Chronicle. Is there something strangely attractive to the criminal justice beat?
Is there something strangely attractive about the criminal justice beat?
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things about the prison beat is that it's so off limits. It's so, mysterious and untouchable. And so there's a desire, at least on the part of some people, such as myself, what the hell's really going on behind those walls? And of course, as far as the crime end of it goes, there's a great deal of drama and tragedy and injustice and so many things swirling around. The world of the streets and crime. And so there are many things that attract writers to these subjects.
And it's hard work. This is not low-hanging fruit. This is more like forbidden fruit.
Absolutely. Forbidden fruit is what it is.
I am talking to Scott Christensen. He is an author. The book in front of me is The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of American Gas Chamber. And your book is relatively extensive historically and otherwise. You've done a lot of research to put this together. But of course, this was the method of execution in California.
This was the method of execution in 11 states, including California, beginning in 1924 and continuing through the 1930s when there was a wave of gas chambers being built in the United States. Of course, it was picked up, in the late 40s. In the late 30s and early 40s by Germany and used to kill millions of people in the Holocaust in Europe. It continued in the United States and some states until finally the last execution by lethal gas occurred in 1999 in Arizona.
And that was in Arizona. Was it one of the choices that they had in Utah gives you a choice.
They did not have the choice of lethal gas in Utah. Utah stuck with
hanging and shooting,
methods,
and
including the firing squad.
Firing squad, hanging, and
and listening to George Bush.
But one of the things that that I note in my book was that there was an a period of moratorium that lasted from the late 1960s to the late 1970s, and at least in the beginning of that period, a majority of Americans were against executions. Hard to believe today, but that was the case back then. And during this moratorium, one of the things that helped to overcome the public disdain for executions in many states was the introduction of yet another method of execution to replace the electric chair and lethal gas, and that was lethal injection.
Which is what
was a method that was claimed to be quick and painless and a humane method of killing. And this was introduced first in Oklahoma in 1977, and then the next day on May 12th, 1977, in the state of Texas.
Yes, and we just did one of those tonight. Mr. George Jones has not survived the execution chamber in Texas this very hour. Where do you think all this is going?
Well, I think it's going, it's been going in a very different direction, and most of the world has certainly been turning away in revulsion from executions. Of course, Texas is a great exception to that, and there are a few other states in America that that also continue to execute people at a high rate. We have a few other countries such as China, which also does a lot of executions. But by and large, most of the world has turned away from capital punishment, and they recognize its many faults, and rather they accept other alternatives as a better way of dealing with murders and other serious crimes.
Even with my personal opposition, it's difficult to see an optimistic future in a state where this is carried out with some glee.
Well, it's mind-boggling to me to witness this continuing. Of course, this is part of what's going on because we also have more people in prison in this country than any other nation in the world. And this is part of our penal complex, part of our punishment complex that we have here in America. And we consider ourselves to be so nice and so gentle and so kind, but in the process, we are killing and imprisoning people for very long periods of time, more than is the case in other nations.
How do you keep from becoming cynical just covering the beat?
Well, the only thing that we can do is try to bring this to public attention, because in a lot of ways it's out of sight, out of mind, and it's a we versus they mentality that is driving a lot of this. And if people are forced to confront it, again, ultimately, I think they will see it for what it is, and they'll turn away from it, as they did decades ago. And I think we'll have another cycle of this. But it's really up to the media and to activists to try to bring this to the forefront and make people come to terms with it and see it for what it is.
One of your books dealt with a slave.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I have drawn a lot of connections between the American experience of slavery, which existed for a couple of hundred years in this country, and the creation and development of the American prison system. And this book, With Liberty for Some, 500 Years of Imprisonment in America, traces that history of slavery and imprisonment over the long course of American history.
Are your books all readily available now?
Not as readily available as I would like. They are out there.
They are out there. Do you have a website?
I do. It's my name, scottchristianson.org, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N-S-O-N.
scottchristianson.org. The title of the book that come to our attention tonight is The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of American Gas Chamber. You know, actually, Scott, California probably has more people on death row than Texas because you're not killing them.
Well, they're just starting to get back to doing that, apparently, in California. And maybe the floodgates will begin to open once again. But for a long period of time, they've had a great buildup of bodies on death row in California.
Yeah, well, we had a surge, I guess you could use that word, of executions during the administration of George W. Bush. Actually, the current governor has actually presided, signed more death warrants than his predecessor. This is pretty regular business down here.
Yes.
It gets increasingly frustrating as well as annoying. I'm fascinated not only about the book I have in hand, but I'm also fascinated about your career. And I might ask you to check us out on theprisonshow.org and see what we do in our spare time.
I would love to do that, and I wish you well in your good work.
And our executionwatch.org has an archive of this discussion and tonight's show. And the difficult thing that Jim and I have is we do this so routinely that we become casual at it. Although on some of our shows, we've actually in our conversation come to the conclusion that they're killing the wrong guy. And that makes our show a little more lively. But the main purpose of doing this, I think, has the same thing to do with the main purpose that Scott Christensen does his work, is bringing the public attention to an anomaly in our society.
Well, you're shining an important light on this, and it really needs to be done.
Thank you, sir, and good evening.
Thank you.
Scott Christensen, an author, and if you look, check the inside fly of his book, and you'll find out that he's written a great many books on the subject. Well, Jim, it's back down to you and I to finish out the hour. How much paper was... how many trees died in this case?
Quite a few, because, number one, there was a lot of kind of false starts in this case. There was a jury picked, and the jury indictment was dismissed because they had it worded incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
Had to start all over again, so they had multiple indictments. That was one thing. Then you had the traditional thing of a very fine lawyer, Richard Anderson, doing the direct appeal. Then you had your state writs. And then they came back on subsequent quits, which, once the Supreme Court said it was violated the Eighth Amendment to execute a retarded person. So there's a lot of appeals done in this case. Although it seems like toward the end, all the lawyers had tried everything they tried. They didn't try for clemency. There toward the end, after all the appeals were heard and all the writs were heard, they just finally said, we quit. And there's been nothing filed.
So what do lawyers do? They get a case, and that's their case. And then this other stuff is happening about retardation, and apparently that juror issue created some paperwork.
What happens, Ray, and this is somewhat discouraging. I know one of the fights, have fights with Will over this. It's difficult when you know in advance, when you're involved in the case, that all you're doing is delaying the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I helped Will on a writ on a death penalty case, and to get the damn thing done, I literally locked myself up in my condo for like a week and a half and did nothing but the writ. And I knew when I was doing the writ. In fact, it was on the guy who murdered Ira Siff, the lady at the mm-hmm. Galley Theater.
Sure.
And I knew when I was doing the writ that it was accomplishing absolutely nothing. At the most you would ever get out of it is a stay of execution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard to get inspired to do that when you realize that what you're doing has no legal merit, and in fact you're delaying the inevitable. And you get kind of the impression after a while that they're asking you to build a sandcastle at low tide, and you want to put a lot of effort into it when you know damn good and well the tide will come in and
wash it away.
And so a lot of this stuff that lawyers do on appeal, it's not that it has merit, is that it simply delays what's going to eventually happen. It doesn't accomplish a whole lot. And it's really, really difficult to work yourself up to a case. It's kind of like doing plastic surgery on a dead body. I mean, you can have a corpse do a great nose job, but they're still dead.
Right.
And so it's kind of hard to get people to get inspired about doing a nose job on a corpse. And it's really, really difficult. And I'm not sure how ethical that is when the only thing you're doing is trying to plug up the system and get just a stay of execution. I'm not sure that's what lawyers should be doing, but they're doing that.
It's part of their culture. That
it's part, exactly right. It's part of that they don't give up. In this particular case, the lawyers tried everything possible, but when you look at the overwhelming evidence of guilt, mm-hmm. when you look at the egregious evidence that came in during the punishment hearing, especially in Dallas County, there's just not a whole lot to work with. I mean, it doesn't give you a lot of room to maneuver. And there's in the worst things you can do if you, and there was talk about lawyers sleeping during trial, which is kind of years ago that happened. The worst thing you can do is have a good lawyer at the trial level.
Yeah.
A good example is when Marvin Teague sure. defended the candy killer, the guy that killed his kid.
Sure.
There's nothing left to appeal.
Right.
It's all over.
He does
with.
A good job.
That's right. And what you really want, if you really are against the death penalty, you want these morons that are incompetent trying the cases. You get real good
confidence. At least it gives you something to talk about.
You've got something to work with. And, but when you have a real good, competent lawyer that does the direct appeal, that does the initial trial, you haven't got much left. And like I say, when this particular case, when they came back and did a subsequent writ after the Supreme Court ruled you couldn't execute retarded people, that was nothing more but a ploy to get more time to reset an execution date.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure the lawyers that worked on the writ knew that. And it's real difficult if you're a lawyer to realize that what you're doing really means nothing, because all you do is maybe get somebody 6 more months, a year. But what's the difference? Does it make they're going to die anyway?
But there seems to be this urgency in the profession. What is it that makes lawyers work even against hope?
Competitiveness.
Competitiveness. It's their reputation. It's
sure.
their reputation they're working for.
And lawyers,
they damn sure are not making a lot of money doing this.
And lawyers have a real bad habit, and this is one thing that I've tried to get lawyers to do. Once you develop a way to try a case, don't ever talk to other lawyers, because you can have some really crazy ideas that you think may work. And you both smoke up each other's rear end thinking it's going to work. And you somehow, you can have the worst possible case. It's kind of like the politician who made a solicitation and called this lady up. She said, "You're a no good crooked SOB. I wouldn't vote for you for if he's the last man on earth." He said, "Mark her undecided," you know.
Right.
And so lawyers sometimes have that same mentality. They can have the worst set of facts possible, and they can come up with some brainstorm thinking there's some possibility there.
Pull a rabbit out of a hat.
That's right. Well, not a rabbit, more than a rabbit. It's a boa constrictor comes out of a hat, not a rabbit. And then you get sucked down to reality. That jury comes back and says, "We're going to give him the death penalty and you 10 years for sitting next to him."
Right.
And then you realize that some of your ideas are not as very bright after all.
Well, actually, Jim, these people, with very rare exceptions, are not making a lot of money.
No. I mean, believe me, there's not any money in doing these cases. I mean, nobody. I mean, I hate death penalty cases. I hate them as a defense lawyer. I've always hated him. Not saying part of it's because you don't believe in the death penalty, but another part is.
Well, prosecutors are not having much more fun.
No. But they, at least they don't get paid whether they're there somewhere at the office chasing the secretary or
right.
writing dirty emails. I mean, but the bad thing about the, when you're a defense lawyer, you've got many people to defend against because you got to defend yourself against, for example, the person that you're trying, plus the people that come back later and claim that you've done something wrong. I'll give you a good example. Robert Pelton, I defended a kid whose name was Kevin. I forgot Kevin's last name. He went to a store in his neighborhood where everybody knew him and robbed it and shot and killed the clerk.
Yeah.
And when the clerk was dying, he hollered Kevin. He went back to the same store a week later and shot and killed another clerk. And there's no question they could identify him, too. I mean, he did 2 murder robberies. And we're going to try the case, and I felt real sorry for him. He was kind of a street kid, and we bought him a suit of clothes, bought him some eyeglasses. He had poor eyeglasses. He cried when we gave him the suit and gave him the glasses. He said no one ever done that, had done that for him before. He was so dumb that he didn't know what the death penalty meant. I tried every way in the world to explain it to him, and the prosecutor was a pretty good guy. And he offered us a life sentence. Well, we jumped at it because that's the least we could have gotten anyway.
Well, sure.
And I told the prosecutor, we have to go through some jury selection. He'd understand the death penalty. And sure enough, when they were picking the first juror, the prosecutor said, "The jury, sure as you're seeing there, we're going to seek the death penalty on this man," pointing her toward Kevin. He started looking around like who they're talking about. I said, "Kevin, they're talking about you. They want to kill you." Well, anyway, we worked it out for a life sentence, and he was real grateful to us for doing that. A month after he's in prison, he sends Robert and I both a letter thanking us profusely for helping him and how much he appreciated us. And enclosed, please find a writ saying that you're ineffective.
Sure.
All in the same letter. And what happened, I know what happened. Some writ writer in TDC convinced him, got a pack of cigarettes or got some commissary from him. And Kevin didn't even know what the writ was because he was thanking us and enclosed, find the writ saying you're incompetent. And you just, after a while, you just get so weary because nobody is in prison, truthfully, for what they did. They're all there because they had a sorry lawyer.
Well, I don't know. I had a pretty good lawyer.
Well,
and I went in prison. And
but you're kind of an exception to the rule, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess so. But the deal is that I'm fascinated here in tonight's show of all shows about the culture. Because it is a culture.
Sure, it's a
lawyers
culture.
Live in a culture, and there's lawyers and judges, and the people you represent are part of your culture.
That's right.
And they have an effect on your culture.
That's right.
And after you get through with doing these wonderful jobs of getting people who are destined to die soon a life sentence, then they go to prison, they run across a convict writ writer who doesn't know anything about the case, hasn't a concept of what happened in that courtroom, but he can make some coffee by convincing your former client, convincing your client to ask you to be incompetent for the purposes of that. And that's about coffee. It's not about reality.
Or a package of Bugler tobacco.
Sure. Whatever, you can't get tobacco in prison these days.
Not anymore. But.
Unless the guard is a good friend of yours. But the deal is that's about things you can buy in commissary. And so that it has distilled down to chump change. No matter how important the case.
Yes.
No matter how positive the ultimate outcome, it is distilled down to what you can buy in commissary.
And another thing, Ray, there's no such thing as a perfect trial. Everybody, because we're human, will make some mistakes during a trial and make some decisions that later turn out not to be good.
Mm-hmm.
There's no error-free trial, and that's just been part of the human nature. And we have to watch out for that because you don't want to commit some error that will get you held incompetent.
Yeah, because your reputation, not only your reputation, but your very bar card, your ticket to the ride.
No, they're not going to get you for that so much. But you just feel horrible if you made a mistake that cost somebody their life. And that would just be unthinkable.
And even if you did not make a mistake, even if you did the very best you could think about doing, sometimes it still don't work.
Be like a surgeon. You'd be the greatest plastic surgeon in the world. You can't make Sophia Loren out of 20 pounds of hamburger meat. And that's what you have in many of these cases. You're asked to perform a miracle on plastic surgery on hamburger meat when there's nothing to work with.
I want to go back to one more thing. It's not fun for the prosecutors either. Because you've played that role.
Right.
You've had to go in and you've had to prosecute people in capital cases.
Well, I've participated as second chair in one. I remember what would be the most morbid thing I can recall. We used to have to stand up in open court and read to the defendant. Now comes the state and then give you notice we're going to seek the death penalty. And I had to do one of those notices one time about 4 days before Christmas. And I kind of had this stupid urge to say, now comes the state, 5 days before Christmas announces their intent to kill you. So that isn't very pleasant.
Thank you, Jim Skelton. Thank you for listening to Execution Watch. We have thanks to give to Elizabeth Stein, our producer, to Otis McClay, our wizard. Jim Skelton, our guest tonight, was Scott Christensen. I am Ray Hill. This is KPFT HD2 channel. Good night.